AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 65 for July 29th, 2010. Have you driven an Explorer lately? Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Later in the show, we're going to have Amy Marentic on, who is the marketing manager for the Explorer. But joining me, as always, the auto extremist himself is in the house, Peter DeLorenzo.
Buongiorno, Johnny.
It's so good to see you here, sir.
Glad you're back.
I'm glad to be back. It's good to be back. And David Welch, too, the man with the facts at his fingertips, as I always say. Good having you here, too.
Good evening, John.
What kind of accent is that?
Some sort of Nordic thing.
Fat, oh, okay.
Fat bastard.
No, it's not fat bastard.
There's the accent I do know. So one of the things I want to talk about, just jump right into it, and we'll get into wherever we want to go with this thing. But last week, one of the reasons I wasn't here is I was on the Volkswagen Jetta trip. They got the new Jetta, and they brought us into their electronics research lab in Palo Alto. And two things there floored me. One that we knew was coming is this autonomous Audi TT that they want to race on Pikes Peak. And I'm telling you, you got to see this thing. I've been trying to dig up the video. I was hoping it was on YouTube. I'm going to have to get VW to give it to me. They're practicing with the car right now. And they went out to some dirt fairgrounds thing, and they've got this turbocharged all-wheel drive TT autonomous sliding through turns.
And they do
absolutely
it.
Sliding.
And by GPS.
It's all by GPS and
completely automatic pilot, basically.
Yeah, and there's no joystick, nothing. They just tell the car, you're here and you gotta go there. Now go. And at the fairgrounds, the fastest they could take it up to was 45 miles an hour. And they said they didn't dare risk it going faster because there's not enough runoff room in case something goes kaflooey. In fact, Ben's got some of the video up on the screen right now of this car driving itself. But it's not the fast driving. This is just around the research labs in Palo Alto or that area. But here's the other cool thing. They were literally shipping the car out the day that I was there to go to the Bonneville Salt Flats. And what they're going to do is, with markers, they're going to lay out flat the Pikes Peak course and just start driving this thing as fast as they can start going. And as you guys know, once you're in Bonneville, I mean, there's miles of runoff room. But they're going to perfect going through all the turns flat at Bonneville, and then in September, they're taking it to Pikes Peak. And they're trying to run it before, I guess the whole thing's going to get paved, unfortunately.
Yeah,
I hate hearing that.
I should ask my buddy Jeff Swart what he thinks, since he just set
the record.
Production record in a rear-wheel drive 911.
Right.
Of 11 minutes and 30 seconds. I mean, I'm sure he's none too happy about this development.
He may not be.
Explain the technology here. I mean, how is this thing driving? Is it purely GPS? Does it have some sensors in case it wanders? What's the...
It's electronic throttle control like all modern cars are today. So the computer just tells it when to open the throttle or close it. It's brake-by-wire system, I believe, essentially. So it does all the braking. I don't think it's electric steering, but I think they've got a servo motor on it, so it does all the steering. It's got GPS, so it knows where it's at. It's got internal map, in this case, of Pikes Peak course. It has sonar and radar. In fact, you can see some of the pods sticking up on the roof. Now, the beauty of this thing is 2 years ago, I was at the DARPA Urban Challenge, where they were doing these things in streets with traffic and having to read stop signs and speed limit signs and obey all that stuff. But here we are 2 years later, and what I should say is at the DARPA Urban Challenge. These things were bristling with antennas and sensors and all that. When you look at this Audi that's going to run at Pikes Peak, there's two little pods sticking out and one little antenna. They're really starting to integrate this stuff. In fact, they told me the Volkswagen that they ran at the DARPA Urban Challenge had $250,000 of sensors in it.
Wow.
This one has got somewhere between $25,000 and $50,000. Still outrageous, but in 2 years, they've taken the cost from $250,000 down to somewhere between $25,000 and $50,000. Give it another couple of years. I mean, before you know it, this is all going to package into the dashboard, no problem.
I don't know. If it's $25,000, it's still going to be a lot of money even 3-4 years from now.
It is, but see, a lot of this stuff is just grabbing whatever sensors off the shelf, whatever electronics off the shelf, and packaging it to make it work. Once it gets perfected, now you can start to say, okay, now we're going to put all the chips on one motherboard or two motherboard. You know, we can start to integrate all these things together, and that's where you really start to miniaturize it and take
cost. You're getting awfully enthusiastic here.
I am.
Are you getting into John DeSico's camp now where we're not going to drive, we're just going to wait for a vehicle to come by and take us
someplace? I've said all along that autonomy is the transformational technology for the automobile as a transportation device. Changing the fuel, changing the engine, it doesn't change the car. This totally changes it because now little kids can get in the car and take it wherever they want. Elderly people who really are not, shouldn't be driving anymore, but who don't want to lose their mobility will now be able to do it. And as I like to say, now we can go back to drinking and driving because we won't really be driving.
What happens if you have somebody like Seth Green's character from The Italian Job hacking into the system?
Well, that's an issue, I'm sure. But, theoretically somebody could hack into traffic lights and start causing accidents.
They worry
accidents.
About that. And it's never happened, but they do worry about it.
Well, if that Audi flies on Pikes Peak off the edge, we'll know something.
That'll put the end to autonomous
horribly wrong.
But, here's another thing. What if, they close off Pikes Peak and you want to see how fast can my car really go? And maybe you think I'm not the driver to do it. Flick on the autonomous program and let this thing just go screaming up the mountainside. I'd rather drive it myself.
Yeah, at that point, I think I'm going to go off the grid.
Right.
I was waiting for you to chime in and say that this autonomous stuff is a bunch of BS.
Well, I mean,
Peter's been skeptical from the beginning.
Well, it's just in the urban centers, I see where they're pushing for it. But beyond that, I'm not interested in it at all.
Getting something like a TT and not driving it.
You go to an urban center and you flip on the switch and you go into the guide mode. That's probably coming in our lifetime for sure.
Oh, that's coming within the decade.
But, the rest of it, I'm not interested in. Once you remove the driving from the equation,
you're not interested.
No.
And to be honest, I'm not either for myself. But I think for the industry and for using the automobile as a transportation device. Now, see, the other caveat that I've always argued is now we have to shoot for a national program that says let's raise the speed limit to 150 miles an hour. And people think I'm joking when I say that, and I'm not joking at all. I'm saying let's put a plan in place, and it's going to take a while to get there, with no degradation in fuel economy or safety whatsoever. But, we've been stuck driving at 70 miles an hour since the 1950s. We haven't progressed at all. And so for half a century, really, the automobile hasn't moved the needle like it really has the capability of doing. And I think autonomy gets you on that path of bumping the speed limit way above what it is today.
But how does it get you anything in terms of fuel economy and energy savings and all that stuff?
Of what, going 150?
No. The autonomy.
Autonomy does it because
steady speed, less congestion. I mean, I could see that, but
yeah, that's how you get it. Exactly right.
I don't see fewer people in vehicles. DeSico is in here pushing autonomy, but he said everybody could have their own vehicle that they don't drive. You still have to move the same number of people.
Yeah, you do, but you can really pack cars nose to tail right now. I mean, literally, it'd be like the NASCAR stockers going 200 miles an hour down the Daytona Straits, nose to tail. You could absolutely do that. You could absolutely put cars nose to tail and get the drafting benefits that NASCAR gets. And that's just from a fuel economy standpoint, from aerodynamics. Then the other thing that you can do is now you can greatly increase traffic density on roads. And where you really get your...
You still get somewhere.
Your high emissions and high fuel consumption is stop-and-go driving. Mm-hmm. Caltrans, the California Transportation Department, this goes back almost 20 years ago, did a study that said if you could just get people to go a steady 40 miles an hour, or even a steady 70 miles an hour, it's so much more efficient than stop-and-go driving. And I can't remember the numbers right off the top of my head, but they were talking something like a 60% reduction in emissions. If you could just do things to make sure that traffic doesn't degenerate into stop-and-go, if you could control traffic in a way just to keep cars moving steadily, you get a substantial improvement, not only in emissions and fuel economy, but also in safety, because it's with speed variance between different cars that they tend to get into accidents.
Interesting.
It was interesting, or is. One other thing, then we'll get on to other stuff, but at this Volkswagen research lab in Palo Alto, they're working on electric cars using laptop batteries. In fact, I learned the proper term is the 18650 battery. That's what you got in your laptop, these lithium-ion things. So I'm talking with this guy who's very excited about using these batteries, and I go, isn't that what Tesla's using? And he goes, yeah, and there's a reason for that. And I said, what's that reason? And he goes, didn't they tell you I'm the co-founder of Tesla? It's this guy named Martin Eberhard.
Oh, yeah, Martin.
Who started the company. You know, Elon Musk
many
is—
many people to at one point have been in litigation with Elon Musk.
Oh, yeah. In fact, he got thrown out of the company, and he will not say why he did, why he was asked to leave.
Oh, that's ridiculous because they got in a lawsuit. There's stuff in public documents. He was blogging about Elon. Elon was talking about him. It was as public as Elon's current divorce. It's completely ridiculous that he won't talk about it. But go on.
So anyway, now it turns out Volkswagen's developing electric cars using these 18650 batteries, the laptop batteries. And, you know, Toyota's got Tesla building them a RAV4 electric prototype, and I think a Highlander, too. So all of a sudden now we've got the two largest car companies in the world going down this path.
So Eberhard is working
for Volkswagen in the research lab.
They said what car they're going to try to put this in?
They weren't all that forthcoming on that. Now, the only thing that Volkswagen has shown is this urban car, the Up, and they've suggested that that might be a candidate for electric power.
So what's interesting is, you know, when Toyota got in bed with Tesla on this thing, everyone said, oh, it's politics, save Noumi and this sort of thing. You know, yeah, that's part of it. The other thing that I've heard, and I did a blog in about this a week ago, is you look at 6,831 laptop cells jammed into a battery pack. That's that many connectors, so that many chances for failure, right?
Right.
The Tesla battery pack shouldn't really work. It shouldn't be reliable. But they haven't had real problems with it so far. Now, that's a little bit of a loaded deck because people don't drive their Tesla Roadsters in, you know, pouring rain or snow. They're only mostly sold in California or, you know, ridiculous heat or on really rough roads. They're toy cars. They're Lotus Elises. They're heavily modified.
Right.
So Toyota is saying, okay, are they onto something here? Let's get their technology, put it in some of our vehicles, and give it some real-world, seriously rigorous testing. And that's what they want to see. Because if Tesla is onto something and the thing would work for cars that people drive every day, serious miles, bad weather, rough road, then that is a cheaper way to go because you've already got a big computer industry cranking out those cells.
Eberhard told me they make 3 billion of these batteries a year.
Yeah, they look like thin shotgun shells. Just crank them out.
Right? Just crank them out. And it's fascinating. And his whole thing is the magic he brings to the party is how to monitor all these cells and make sure if one's starting to overheat and you move more current to another cell and all the stuff that I don't understand. But that's the magic he's bringing. So he doesn't care what the battery is. And he's just saying these are the least expensive, highest energy density batteries that you can get right now.
And to save our viewers some of the suspense of why Martin left, Elon blamed him for a lot of the cost overruns for the Roadster initially. There may have been other reasons that Martin maybe isn't telling us, and he's probably now, since they settled, contractually bound not to say it. But they were in a big, very public tit-for-tat over who was responsible for cost overruns and that sort of thing. And they had an interim CEO, and I can't remember his name now, but he gave me an interview, and he said he didn't really blame either one of them. He said, you start a new company, and you're trying to get people to supply you parts and systems. You can't guarantee volume. You can't guarantee anything, and they jack up the price. And until you have some legitimacy, you're going to get bad prices. So it wasn't necessarily Martin's fault. But they had this whole argument, and he quit. You know, obviously, Musk is tough to work for because they've had a lot of turnover there.
But we should get Martin on the show here because—
We should get Elon on the show, too.
Well, yeah, not at the same time.
At the same time. That's great.
Actually,
television.
That'd be a great show. What am I saying? Right. And then the
Farrago,
other—
Farrago, too.
Pardon?
And Farrago.
Oh.
It should be like—
Get him back, yeah. And then I got a chance to drive the new Jetta, too, and that's a kind of interesting car because it looks pretty good to my eye. I think it's well-styled. But they've made this thing big. This has got to be the biggest car in that class right now. It's got gobs of backseat legroom. They claim it's almost the same as a 7 Series BMW. But they didn't cheat the design. In other words, you get good knee room in the back, leg room in the back, and still have a really good-sized trunk.
Does it drive and feel like a Volkswagen?
Yes.
Because they took a lot of cost out.
They did take a lot of cost out. And it doesn't have that rock-solid, Autobahn, let's-drive kind of feel to it. It's a good car. It's a very competent car. And, you know, what they kept emphasizing is Civic and Corolla. That's what it's going up against. And certainly, if you want to benchmark it against those two, it's a pretty damn good car. But to your point, is it as good as the last Jetta? I don't think so. It's not as nimble as it was.
The thing is, Volkswagen, with the Jetta and Passat replacements, wants to compete for volume
right.
in this market. That's why they've got the plants here and in Mexico to lower their labor costs. They're going for high sales volumes, and they're dropping the price down. And it's not all just labor. Granted, the difference between Mexican or American labor and even American labor to German labor is pretty good cost savings. But they got to be stripping some of this out because then that's what GM and Ford have for years done is they take these cool European cars, water them down, strip them down, and they wouldn't sell here.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see. You've driven it. I haven't. But interesting to see how Volkswagen executes this and how the car does.
Well, they also reposition it because of the car they're coming out with in Tennessee, which is going to be their real...
And that's a very good point, Peter.
Mainstream. It's clearly a position. They lowered the price.
A lot, though. I mean, they've dropped the price. You know,
about $2,000.
They're positioning for this.
Oh, for the midsize? For the Passat? The Passat goes.
No! I'm talking about the Jetta.
They want to sell the new midsize car. The NMS is what they code for it for like 21 or 22.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But that's why they did what they did with the Jetta.
Right. Be careful, though, because they're bragging like, oh, you can get this Jetta for about $16,000. Yeah, if you don't pay the destination charge, $770. You want an automatic transmission, and even in this country with Volkswagens, most of them, 90% of them are going to be automatics.
That's another
$1,000 or $1,100.
Well, the destination charge is something that everybody has to pay, and marketers talk about it, or they don't talk about it. It's like it doesn't exist.
I think it's dishonest not to include that in the price.
It is.
I think it's deceptive.
It's $770, $740, depending on the manufacturer. It's serious money.
It's serious money, and you can't buy the car without it. You can't say, I'll do without the destination charge.
Keep the formats in the destination.
Right. Right.
I'll pick it up at the plant myself.
That's right. So what else? Did you guys see this thing, Eaton and... The EPA and the city of Ann Arbor are coming out with garbage trucks that are hydraulic hybrids.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
I think that's pretty interesting.
Fitting for Ann Arbor.
Yeah, right. The People's Republic.
Well, you had a picture of it today on Autoline Daily.
On Daily, yeah, we did.
Somebody else was working on a hydraulic pickup or a hydraulic hybrid system. And it's kind of neat how it works. It's basically just circling air pressure back and forth.
Well, this is hydraulic pressure. Because
there's air systems and there are fluid systems
right.
where they get a little bit of sort of low end acceleration, and it's great for something like that. You're carrying heavy loads, and you've got a lot of stop and go.
Yeah, and the cost of a hydraulic accumulator, you know, just one big tank, is a whole lot cheaper than lithium-ion batteries. And if you got a big truck, it packages real easy. You know, you just put it between the frame rails, you know, to one side of the drive shaft, no problem. So I just find this interesting, and that's why I like the Porsche, what's that, that 911R GT that's got the hybrid or the flywheel.
Yeah, 911 GT3 RS hybrid.
So again, you know, what I find interesting is there's a whole lot of ways to do hybrids. You don't necessarily have to rely on a battery.
How about Porsche green lighting the 918?
That's pretty cool.
For 650 bills.
Well, 650. Didn't they say if they got 1,000 orders, they would green light it?
Well, they got 2,500 serious inquiries. So, yeah, they're going to, for 650.
Wow. David, one thing.
It's going to cost you a lot to go green.
Makes the SLR look cheap.
Yeah, makes a lot of things look cheap. I think I'd get a 2458 Italia Ferraris for that and call it good.
Boy, when you put it that way.
Yeah. I'd get a white one for the daytime and a black one for at night. It's all good.
With a custom leopard skin dash.
No.
Hey, one thing I wanted to ask you quick before we bring Amy on the show here. Daimler, Volkswagen, Peugeot, Nissan, Hyundai, all reporting this week solid, solid profits. I thought this was a year where the industry was still going to be limping along.
They cut a lot out. I was just looking at some numbers because, of course, we have Obama visiting Detroit tomorrow to go to Chrysler and GM plants and Ford after that. And looking at all that's happened in the past year, you know, from bailout through bankruptcies, and the U.S. automakers, just the big three now, have taken out 2.9 million units of capacity.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it was 25%. So you're looking at a market that's not even to 12 million cars and trucks, and they're making money, and they're getting good pricing. We're up to $28,400 for your average vehicle sold in the U.S. That's real pricing.
That's real pricing.
It might be the highest average price we've ever had. Or
actually, the
not,
number I saw was 29,000 and change.
Yeah, there are different people measuring it, but it's
well, my prediction all along has been by 2015, it's going to be $35,000 is going to be the average price of a car. That's my prediction. 5 years.
35. That's a long walk.
It is a long walk, but you just wait until all these this green technology to meet CAFE kicks in.
That's a good point.
It don't come cheap.
Be careful, though, because it's the first few years of CAFE are not, they're not hard to hit at all. And the publicly, the people at the car companies will say it is, and privately they tell me it's not.
Right. That's true. But by 15, you got to have all your ducks in a row. Yeah, it's quote-unquote easy to meet, but you're still going to be doing it with more expensive engines, more expensive transmissions, more expensive materials in the cars.
People buy smaller vehicles.
And those smaller vehicles will be priced.
Because remember, there are also people predicting that we're going to be near peak oil by mid-decade. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I buy that, but I think oil will be more expensive by then, and people will be perhaps helping the car makers meet CAFE by wanting to buy something cheap.
That'll make it easy.
Oil's going to go up.
Yeah, there's no question.
I don't care. Anyone,
the problem is,
we're just getting, the whole country's getting lulled now. And then I can just feel it coming.
Oh, by the way, wasn't there just a survey a week or two ago that 75% of people opposed the offshore drilling ban?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I hate to say I told you so, but I think I was the only one on the set here saying that it wouldn't be long after the whole Gulf oil spill that we'd get collective amnesia. Oh, yeah. Thank God we got through that one. And people are back to loving oil, just like we're back to buying, you know, bigger cars now than we were a while back.
You were right on that. Yes, you were.
I was wrong about how fast it happened. I thought it would take a while, but the crisis is really, there's still cleanup going on, a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And you see a survey like that. So, yeah, we're in the comfort zone. Peter's right.
Well, hey, this is a good time to bring Amy Marentik on the show. Amy, come on up. And I'll explain as you come up on the set here with us that you are with Ford Motor Company, and can you clip on your mic there? And I want to say the marketing manager for the new Explorer. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, I do marketing for our cars and crossovers.
All cars, all crossovers.
All our cars in North America.
So that's everything but the trucks.
Mustang and Taurus and Flex and Edge.
So, and now Explorer.
And now Explorer.
Which you guys showed to us in the media about a week ago or so. And the thing that I found so interesting about it is one of the messages that came out of it is the SUV is not dead. Despite all these obituaries that were written for the SUV, it's not dead. And what you folks were saying is there are a lot of people out there who still want SUVs, albeit with some changes to them.
Absolutely. The idea of adventure and go anywhere and always be ready has not gone away. But their expectations on fuel economy and product freshness have changed.
But go anywhere. I mean, you know, you don't need an SUV. I mean, do you? Couldn't you get a station wagon and sort
sure.
of do the same sort of things? I think, isn't it the look of the vehicle that they want as much as these other attributes?
It's absolutely the image, right? And then four-wheel drive is very important. Towing is very important. And the ability to carry seven people and all of their gear. So when we ask customers, that's how they define an SUV.
How popular will they get? You know, in its heyday, the Explorer, as you know, sold over 400,000 units a year. It's a staggering number when you think about it. I think it's on track this year to do about 60,000, the current model, not the new one.
Right.
So you must have plans to at least double those sales with the new one.
Well, you know, we don't talk about volume projections because we always know we'll be wrong, right? Certainly isn't a single point forecast, but we do expect to get our fair share, and we expect Explorer to do very well. Our secret weapon is we have a lot of Explorer customers out there. We've built over 6 million, and 4 million are still on the road.
And you have that, 96% name recognition,
yeah.
Which is staggering.
That is staggering.
Which is, you know, because people are saying, well, why is Ford doing that? I had a lot of readers, right? I said, why wouldn't they do it? You have this gold nameplate.
How much baggage is there still, if any, from the Firestone tire thing was quite a while ago.
I don't think there's any baggage from that. I really don't.
When we ask customers what you think when you think Explorer, they say adventure, family, fun. So most people have very good memories of their time in their Explorer. And most people have either had an Explorer or know somebody who had an Explorer. So the memories are very fond. And we talked to a lot of these customers. And when we did our launch, we launched it on Facebook. And so we had the opportunity to get real-time feedback very, very quickly. And it was very fun to read the reports from the customers and, you know, what they wanted and what they were looking for.
But, you know, a while back, and it wasn't all that long ago, people are talking about SUVs or Explorer in particular go upside down. People get killed in these things. They're gas guzzlers. They're bad for the planet. And there's got to be people who remember that, too, or not those who are interested in buying the new one.
Well, I think what's really important is with the new Explorer, the idea is 100% reinvented. Everything has been changed, but nothing has been compromised. So from the time we actually kicked off the program, that was the idea around it, 100% reinvented. So we wanted to build on everything that Explorer did well, but we wanted to fix the things that customers were disappointed in. And there were two things. One was fuel economy, and the other was how fresh the product was. So I think when you see the styling of the product, the idea was very modern, very capable, but also still signal Explorer. And, you know, we shifted it to a unibody platform, right, to improve the driving dynamics, to improve the fuel economy. But then also, the fuel economy had to be jaw-dropping. And that's a word that we've used from day one. So our goal, what we've committed to is over 30% improvement. Fuel economy.
Now, you haven't announced the number yet. Why?
We haven't because we're still working on it.
And 30% improvement over what exactly?
The current.
Okay.
So the current V6. So we don't certify till the very last minute. And what we do is literally until the very end, we are working on just little things.
I believe, and I've gone out and said this, that you guys really want to have a 30-mile-per-gallon highway number on that.
Well, that would be with the four-cylinder, right?
Yeah, what we're adding to Explorer, we will have a 3.5 TIVCT twin independent variable cam timing engine with 290 horsepower.
I'm sorry, when you say 30% over the current V6, With which engine? I mean, is it V6 to V6 or?
So V6 to V6 will be more than 20% better. So outgoing to incoming, but we're adding horsepower. So 290 horsepower will be the new engine. V6 to I4 EcoBoost will be over 30% improved.
Got it. That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that's interesting is the EcoBoost has got 53 fewer horsepower than the V6. It only has 5 foot-pounds of torque less, and that torque peaks at 1,700 RPM, or hits the max at 17, and it goes, I don't know, another couple of thousand RPM beyond that. Have you driven the EcoBoost one?
That's the beauty of EcoBoost. My favorite thing about EcoBoost is the flat torque curve. So literally, for 80% of the drive cycle, you have 100% of the torque, and that feels really good. 250 pound-feet of torque feels very, very good when you have it through almost your entire drive cycle. And we just had our dealers in it. We had our dealer product committee in, and they were very, very pleased. Very, very pleased.
Yeah, I'm dying to drive that version because on paper, it doesn't look half bad. Sometimes on paper, things can look better than they are. That's why I'm dying to drive the EcoBoost in that Explorer.
I agree. You know, I worked on the original 3.5 EcoBoost, and, you know, I was part of the team that made the decision to say no V8s in Lincoln. Save Navigator, right? That was a big decision. But I tell you, you saw that engine on paper, and it was beautiful. And we all kept our fingers crossed. I know I did. And said, boy, I hope when I drive that engine, it feels as good as it looks. And I'll never forget the first time I drove it. We were at our proving grounds. We were driving it back-to-back versus a North Star and just blew the doors off the North Star. It was a great day, right? So now I see the torque curve of the 2-liter I-4. And who could imagine a 2-liter I-4 powering an Explorer?
Yeah, we can. That's right? Why we've got to drive it.
But with that 250 pound-feet of torque, it actually feels very good. And it delivers great fuel.
I'll be interested in driving it myself to really see if it's going to carry the load.
I can't wait to hear what you guys think.
Yeah. So this thing doesn't go on sale until early next year, though, right?
Winter. We start building at the end of this year, and it will go on sale winter.
Okay.
Winter. It's an 11.
That's up to March 21st.
Well, yeah, we're hoping before that. Sometime between December 21st and March 1st, right?
How long have you been working on this program?
Since the beginning.
So what's that, like 3 years back or something like that?
Yeah, usually 2 to 3 years we start the strategy. But, yeah, since the very beginning.
How do you position this as you go to market? Because the new Grand Cherokee is going to beat you out in the showroom. It's in showrooms right now. And both sort of vehicles that have the same kind of footprint and similar pricing and that sort of thing. How do you look at the Grand Cherokee as competition?
Well, I do believe that there will be some cross-shop there, but a little bit different strategy, right? Ours was about 100% reinvented. It's really the SUV for the 21st century. So significant improvements in fuel, 30% versus 11%. We're standard 3-row. They're 5-row only, or 5-pass only. They're more of a... You could say rock climber. We're not a rock climber. We have our terrain management system that is calibrated for snow, mud ruts, or sand. We also have a normal mode. We have 5,000 pounds of towing. What we've tried to do is really hit the sweet spot. We've also lost weight instead of gained weight, and we've added a lot of content. So the idea was 100% reinvented, treading lighter on the environment, jaw-dropping fuel economy, 25% recycled content, 85% recyclable. So I think it was just a different product strategy versus Grand Cherokee. I don't know what their strategy was, but when I look at the data of their vehicle, I think they were going a little bit different direction.
Yeah.
Where do you see that whole segment going?
I see the segment blurring. And the way that we're starting to look at it at Ford is more utilities in total. And utilities in total include small utes, crossovers, medium utes, large utes, premium utes. And we look at all of those together, it's a formidable business. It's 30%. And it's actually projected to grow in the next 2 years.
30% of what? The total market?
Total retail industry. Hmm. So one out of every 3 vehicles purchased is a utility. So we see those lines blurring, but we know that we need a full line of product in order to get our fair share. And frankly, the area where we have the gap right now is in that Explorer area because a lot of our customers are leaving to go to other SUVs, and that's unacceptable.
Where are they going? Which brands?
Honda Pilot, Toyota Highlander, GM.
To the what we call the Lambda base.
The Lambda.
The Traverse, the Enclave.
Yep. And that doesn't make any of us very happy, right? Some of them go to Edge. Some of them go to Flex. But there are people that still want...
This might be a rare moment in Autoline After Hours history. Someone working for a car company actually admitted that their direct competitor was taking some customers.
Yeah.
We appreciate your candor. That's great.
Yes.
But I will also...
The truth always wins.
But I will also tell you that I'm taking them back. And I'm confident in that.
And the price is what? You knocked $1,000 off the price?
We did. We knocked $1,000 off. We added some content. It'll start at $28,995. Does include D&D.
It does.
Always include D&D.
Yes. Destination and delivery.
Yes. $31,995 for the XLT, $37,995 for the Limited. I expect the majority of our mix will be an XLT with our second level package, which is leather and my Ford Touch, which is the next big thing at Ford.
So you're talking about $35,000, $34,000?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I expect the majority of the mix to kind of be right at that $34,000.
Are you going to be able to offer better leases? I mean, I imagine you've done things to try to improve your residuals.
We do. We'll have a very competitive lease, and we're also our returning Explorer customers. I call them our secret weapon. There are 4,140,000 come back every year. We're going to treat them extra special.
How so?
We're going to give them some extra money to encourage them to purchase.
It's like a loyalty coupon sort of thing?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
So Ford needs it.
Ford needs it. No question.
How will you market it compared to how you traditionally marketed Explorer? This is a unibody vehicle, so it will be more efficient. It's a more modern SUV, but it's not body on frame, so maybe not quite as good at towing, hauling, and the rugged sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Not a rock climber like you said the Grand Cherokee is. So how does the marketing change?
Yeah, I think the marketing will evolve. It will, the inspiration, I know I say this a lot, I apologize if you're getting sick of it, but the 100% reinvented, right? So that will be the idea behind our marketing. But in terms of our terrain management and our towing, I believe it will actually be better. Our terrain management system is literally calibrated for each surface. So we change either engine throttle, our shift schedule, our traction control based on the surface. And what you want in sand is almost the exact opposite of what you want in snow. So we've also made it very simple where you just turn a switch. You know, I was at a marketing research event where I was riding around with this woman, and I said, well, tell me when you go into four low. And she said, I never touch that button. And I said, well, why not? She said, I don't know what it's going to do. Well, we want to take that away, make it very simple but also very capable. Now, from a towing perspective, towing's actually better. It's 5,000 pounds, but we've added trailer sway control from our F-Series. We've added tow haul mode. We have a rear camera that zooms 3 times, and we also have hill descent. So from that perspective, I think it's getting even better. So I think we have everything that we had before and then some, but we also have this idea around treading lighter on the environment. And that's a message we'll go out with.
One more thing, and then we'll get to rapid fire, is this is going to be the first Ford vehicle, I believe, with the inflatable seat belts in the rear.
Yeah.
Is that a standard feature on the vehicle?
No. Typically, the way that we start with safety features is we have them option on every series. So if they're important to the customer, they can absolutely get them. And then over time, we see what the response is, and then we move to standardize. Now, with rear inflatable belts, the reason we made the decision that we did is they really work well when you have people in the rear of the vehicle, especially children. And what the belt does is it deploys like an airbag in the event of a crash, and it spreads the forces out about 5 times. So instead of having the force, right here, it just spreads it out, which is really good for children. If you don't have children in the back seat of your car, you do not need the feature. If you do, you will want the feature.
I think that's the kind of feature where people are going to grab their neighbors and say, come look at this. Look what's in the back seat. I think it's going to be the first safety feature that people will want to show their neighbors. That's my guess.
We are so excited about it for a couple reasons. Even the base belt, without it deploying, customers say is more comfortable because it's a little bit padded. It looks like a regular seatbelt, but it's a little bit padded. And then it works with every car seat, a rear seat, a rear-facing seat, a front-facing seat, a booster seat, or a child that's in without a seat at all. So it works for everybody, and it also helps seniors as well. So it's a great feature. It's a visible feature people can see, and they can kind of wrap their head around.
What will you charge for it?
Not much. I think it's somewhere around $200.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a crazy amount.
Okay, good. We'll have to keep an eye on, see how that sells.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, let's get to rapid fire. And Ben, let's bring up the graphic.
We didn't get to see the graphic.
Oh, that's
it's
the
like
delay.
A Kung Fu movie.
Yeah, right.
That's kind of scary.
Okay, here's a first question tonight is from Christian Ticianu. This is our buddy from Romania. And he says, just the other day, I watched a beautiful movie on Autoblog about the 1970 Sebring 12 Hours race. And I learned that one of the Corvettes was driven by Tony DeLorenzo. I wonder if there's any relation between him and Peter DeLorenzo, the co-host of Autoline After Hours.
Yeah, that's my older brother.
How'd he do in the race?
70... He won in 69 and 70, I think they won in 72.
Wow. He says, by the way, I think Peter is a great guy and a very competent analyst of the auto industry, but I think he misspelled analyst. It looks more like analyst.
I'll send him a check tomorrow.
David Arnoldson from Las Vegas says, my question for the Ford rep, could you ask her about a future clean, small diesel? What about a diesel in the Explorer? Now, you've had diesels in the export markets.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we typically don't comment on future plans, but I will tell you...
Oh, there's a good answer.
We did have a lot of discussion around diesel for launch, and our strategy, and I think it was a good one in hindsight, because we did struggle, was the EcoBoost engine. We thought that that was a better use of the customer's money.
What about overseas? Ford's bragging about selling this in 90 different countries.
Yes.
And I got to believe diesels got to go in that thing if you're going to sell them in Europe, for example.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can't tell you about our future plans, but right now we're launching with two gas engines, one EcoBoost, one naturally aspirated.
Okay. David, I think there's more engines to come just based on what Amy's saying here. Here's Shan, who says, I've got a question for Amy. How does the curb weight of the 2011 Explorer compare to the last generation?
Yeah, we're down about 100 pounds. Doesn't sound like a lot. However, when you've added all the content, and it's also the vehicle's 5 inches wider than the outgoing Explorer, so you really feel that when you sit in the vehicle. You've got more shoulder room, you've got more headroom, and it's also about four inches longer. So the vehicle's bigger. We've added a ton more content, but we've taken weight out, which is a little bit of a different strategy versus our competitors.
It also looks a whole lot better.
Looks a whole lot more modern.
Yeah, people are going to be pretty stunned when
especially
they see
the interior.
Yeah, when they see it on the road, though, it's going to be like, whoa.
Michael Shipley wants us to answer, did Ford kill Mercury too soon as the Lincoln lineup does not yet fill the void? Or have you guys seen something coming that we don't know about?
Answer's no.
No.
They didn't kill it too soon.
I would agree with
that.
They
got great stuff coming.
But I think he's got a good point in that this is going to be a big drop-off in volume for the dealers.
Well, yeah, but there's never a good time. There's never a good time. I mean, what are you going to wait?
Amen.
This idea of preserving brands or nameplates or throwing extra nameplates to a brand because dealers want it is just it's a terrible way to run a business.
Comment from Ford Guy. What do you think of the new F-150 V6 turbo at 400 horsepower and 400 pound-feet of torque and 20 miles to the gallon? Will the F-150 continue to reign? R-E-I-G-N.
I think so. But, you know, some of the hardcore truck people are just going to go, I'm not running a V6 in my truck. But I think the more... enlightened out there will say, hey, this is pretty good. I can get basically what I need and get that extra mileage. I think it's a good move on Ford's part.
I drove an EcoBoost V6 F-150 3 years ago, one of the test mules, and the engineers asked me, so what do I think? I said, you should just put V8 on the fender, and most nobody is going to know the difference. I said, all you have to do is monkey around with the exhaust note. Because you can hear this isn't a V8, but every other sensory feel in the acceleration and all that just said V8 all over it. I think it'll do just fine.
Yeah,
Ford's got a big leg up in the pickup truck market right now because GM's truck is old and they're not replacing it for a few more years. They've got the new half or three-quarter and one-ton out right now, and I'm driving it, and it's pretty good. The Ram really hasn't done it. Ford's got a few more years to run.
Ford's
really
got that,
picking up share.
They've got their mojo back on the...
Well, they do. I mean,
you want to know why Ford keeps making so much more money than GM. the advantage in the pickup market is big,
including the heavy duty.
Yeah, GM's going to take some of that
Super Duty in Ford's case, right?
Yeah, GM's going to take some of that share back because they haven't redented their current. Talk about cars that are old enough to shave. Their current big pickups really are, but they've got the new one coming out right now. That's pretty impressive.
Well, here's another good segue then. George in Ohio says, can you guys talk about Alan Mulally saying on live TV, new Ranger? He said this is because Ford's been saying no new Ranger and stopped and is saying that it's going to stop production within a year or two. Peter D. months ago said he had seen the new Ranger and it was beautiful.
I said that.
Somebody thinks you did. George in Ohio thinks you did.
You know, I think Ford would be remiss not doing a new Ranger, but, you know, I don't.
Well, here's the problem is there is a new Ranger, yeah. But it's for the rest of the world, not for the U.S.
Yeah.
And the reason it wouldn't come here is the price would go up enough that it'd be stepping on the toes of the lower end of the F-150 range. So I don't know what you do. But if Alan Mulally said new Ranger on live TV, I would think there's something to that.
Well, yeah, but Alan's thinking globally all the time. So.
Yeah.
True, that's true.
Everybody has toyed with this idea, and the problem is you can discount your full-size pickup with a V6 and get to the price of that compact or midsize pickup or close to it pretty quickly.
The only one who does well with a compact pickup is Toyota with the Tacoma.
Nissan has done well with the Frontier.
Has it? I haven't looked at those numbers lately.
Lately, I'm not sure. I haven't looked at them either, but it's been a stronghold for Nissan for a while.
Well, Toyota puts a lot of effort into the Tacoma, and I imagine Nissan puts a fair amount of effort into the Frontier.
Mm-hmm.
Pedro Fernandez wants to know, he says, I don't understand why the Volt has to cost over $40,000. You'd think the technology would cost about the same as a hybrid system. It seems to me to be less complicated. It is less complicated. That's a good point.
A lot more battery, though.
But the batteries are so horrifically expensive.
And they're so big. That's a big battery.
I'm willing to, just a guess, wild-ass guess, that GM is going to lose money on everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what they say. They're losing money on everyone.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I don't think they've really fought that that idea either, that they're going to lose money. I think the pricing strategy, I was told internally they wanted to get under 40,000, but it was the whole pricing strategy was how much can we tolerate losing on this thing?
Yeah.
And they've got a competitive lease rate with a price that's significantly higher than the Leaf. I don't think that many people are going to lease it, but...
You don't?
I think leasing's going to be that $350 a month. That's going to be huge.
That's attractive. I mean, that's affordable.
Or anything like that. Sure, it is, but it's tougher to qualify for a lease these days.
It may be, but I tell you,
For the people who are
uncertain technology with a lease, at the end of the lease, you walk away.
Well, I'd rather lease it than buy it. I'm just saying it's tougher to qualify for a lease.
Plus, think of the early.
Now, they do have AmeriCredit, but
well, think of the early adopters of the Volt. Who are they going to be? You know who they're going to be.
Everybody coming out of their Prius.
Well, yeah. Well, it's going to be California.
But you guys know that you don't walk out of there with $350 a month on the lease, right?
What? What do you mean?
Well, there are all kinds of fees. There are add-ons. Do you get the interest rate that gives you $350 a month? Do you qualify for that? It's not that easy. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Now, they bought AmeriCredit, and the main reason for buying AmeriCredit was to do leasing. So that could play
some
in there.
Some of us might be able to get $350 a month, huh?
I just think the early adopters of the Volt will be able to qualify for any lease from any company, probably.
Hey, we've got some phone calls coming in here. And, Ben, let's bring in a phone call.
Hi, this is Derek V. from Plainfield, Illinois. And for the guest tonight, I got to say the new Ford Explorer looks awesome. I really like the way it looks. It actually seems to have a little Land Rover influence there, maybe one of the lasting things from that orphaned OEM. But that just leads me to the question, is there going to be a Explorer Sport, the two-door version coming out? Because that three-quarter view looks very, very nice, and it looks like it could accommodate a two-door model. So look forward to the comments, and hopefully we'll see something like that. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'll answer that for Amy. We don't comment about future plans.
Well, I'll tell you a little secret. Our chief program engineer spent about 5 years at Land Rover. and worked on the Range Rover and Range Rover Sport. His name's Jim Holland. He did a fantastic job with the Explorer. So I can tell you, based on Jim's heritage, the vehicle will be very capable. Right now, we have no plans for Sport Track. How do you like that?
Oh, she's not commenting on future product because there ain't going to be no two-door. That's got to be expensive to do. That would be separate body side apertures to stamp out, tool up. That's mucho dinero.
We do the business case, and you know, we try to understand the need and the want. But what customers want from the Explorer is the package and the ability to haul people. And so that's why the three-row was so important.
But what was the Sport? What was the mix before with Sport? Wasn't it about a quarter?
Not even.
Okay. Ben, let's bring in another call.
Hey, this is Youngblood from Cleveland, Ohio, calling.
Hey, Youngblood.
Kudos to the Sports Car Club of America for their World Challenge Championship. Just think of this. Fantastic Ford, Chevy, Dodge, Cadillac, Mercedes, BMW, Honda, Mitsubishi, Infiniti, Nissan, Lexus, all on the same track, all stuff we can tell what it is. We can look at them and realize that they're a Chevy, a Mustang, a Camaro, a Challenger. I mean, great. It doesn't get any better than this. Back in the late 60s, I was a young buck, and I enjoyed the Trans Am series. It's the 21st century now. I'm an old fart, but I'm still enjoying the racing. By the way, P.S., rest in peace, NASCAR. You will never get it.
Well, he's a reader, and I put that on the line that the World Challenge is focusing on Camaro, Mustang, and Challenger, along with their other imported competitors. I think it's a brilliant stroke.
Well, as I was listening to him, I thought we should put this to music because he's singing our song.
Yeah.
Keep going, Ben. Let's bring in another one.
Yeah, John, this is Rick from San Diego. Two quick topics. So one, the NASCAR thing that you guys were talking about. To me, it should be Mustang, Camaro, and Challenger. That's it. I do not and will not watch Toyota go around. That's why I quit watching NASCAR. And I used to go to the races and everything. And on the production cars, it got to work at our old BMW 1602 at work, and I was thinking, do you think maybe Chevy, General Motors as a Chevy or a Buick possibly could resurrect that style, or maybe even Ford or even Chrysler? Small four-cylinder coupe, pretty basic, maybe around $25,000, maybe get some excitement going in the small rear-wheel drive car. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, you know, I would agree. We love those kinds of cars. You know, small compact coupes, you know, good power to weight ratio. Boy, they just don't sell that well, though. That's the only thing.
Yeah, and he's talking rear wheel drive, too. Yeah,
so go get a standard 011 Mustang. Call it good.
Yeah, that's what you'd have
Camaro.
To do. But I do like that.
Or a Synergy Green Camaro.
That's right.
The David Welch edition.
Let's keep them rolling, Ben. Bring in another call.
I think I did better last week with.
Hi, this is John from New York. When are you going to put an EcoBoost V6 in the new Ford Explorer so it can be as useful as the old Explorer? Thank you very much. Bye.
That's a good question.
Oh, I'm sorry he hung up. Well, again, we've had a lot of requests for the 3.5 EcoBoost and Explorer. So it won't be there at launch. At launch, what we wanted to do was focus on fuel economy, but make sure we had a very capable vehicle. So the 290 horsepower of the V6 will be very capable. We'll drive great. It will do everything that you need to do. We are looking at a 3.5 EcoBoost. We haven't committed to anything, but we've had a lot of requests.
Watch it, Amy. You're talking about future product.
I know. I can say no comment to everything.
There you go. That's the right answer.
What I can tell you is we've had a lot of requests for it.
Oh.
By the way, are you hemmed in because of CAFE? I'm putting the more powerful V6 into the Explorer.
Mm-mm.
Even going on 5 years, you're okay if you were to put something.
I don't know. I haven't looked at it 5 years out.
Our viewers should know because this is a great question. You were famous. You were on Conan O'Brien's show, and you did a whole thing with the Taurus with his old SHO and talking about the new one. So Bo Jackson wants to know, what was it like to be in the trunk of Conan O'Brien's Taurus show?
It was really dirty.
You were in the trunk?
Yeah. It was completely unscripted. And he starts to get into my Taurus show, and he's 6'7".
Is he that tall?
Brian.
He
had no idea.
So tall.
I had no
so
idea.
So tall. So he starts to get in my trunk, and I'm thinking, I hope he fits. And he fit like a glove. There was tons of room. And then he started the Blair Witch Project thing. And then we got out, and we were in his car. His car was filthy. And one of the writers comes up, and the writer says, wouldn't it be funny if she got in our trunk? And I said, well, if you clean it, I will. So they did, and I got in. But it was dirty.
Here, we're running a bit of the clip. Anybody who wants to see this, Amy Marentic with Conan O'Brien, just go to YouTube. The video is there, and it's been there for some time.
I didn't know he was 6'7".
I had no idea. Yeah.
That might not be completely accurate, but he's really, really tall.
Tall dude, yeah.
He's 6'4" or 5", anyway.
Cool.
I have heels. Yeah, there I go.
Okay, well, let's bring in another phone call here, Ben.
Hi, it's Derek V. from Plainfield, Illinois again. Actually, just commenting on Eco Motors. Really digging the whole Eco Motors approach. I think it's a really neat design, and everything about it sounds really good. But I would like you guys to comment on the long wait. I mean, I understand the challenges OEMs have with introducing something like this into their engine program, as you've discussed before. But why wait, you know, another year or two for the development? I get that part. But then the whole delay for getting it into mass production or whatever, why not go factory direct right as soon as they get through all the testing and R&D? Get some of these old cars like a 05 Cavalier and some talented wrencher to fabricate engine mounts and adapter plates. I mean, let's get these things out here, man. I'm kind of interested. I got a 79 Porsche 924 waiting right now for a transplant. So comment on that, if you will, as far as getting it out before production lines and out into just direct factory purchasing. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, I have a story in the magazine coming out tomorrow on Eco Motors. And I interviewed John Coletti and Don Runkel for it. And, you know, Coletti said that he thinks the biggest obstacle is just going to be the NIH, not invented here.
Yep.
There are really three problems, though. One is not invented here. You go and to even Toyota or somebody and you say, we've got an engine that's better than yours, it's more efficient, and you know, three of us designed it, and they've got this huge R&D and powertrain group, and they say, yeah, sure. Second thing is, because of the shape of the engine, you're going to have to do some tear-up under the hood to fit it. That's a design change that everybody's going to have to do. And third, you're going to have to somehow change the assembly lines in engine plants. And that's more capital. And engine plants are done out sometimes as long as 10 years, so you're looking at some tear-up. So between the initial, you know, you're a crazy inventor, get out of my office, to the other capital problems and risk, it's a tall order.
But I think they're onto something.
I think they are. Absolutely.
I do too. Well, you know, and again, because why? Coletti, Runkel, Hofbauer. Been there, done that kind of guys. They know what they're going up against going into the industry. Mm-hmm. But Hofbauer said a very interesting thing. And it was your question, I think. One of your questions, but I think it was yours, David, that if you were still back at Volkswagen and somebody brought this engine to you that you just invented, what would you do? And he said, I'd probably put it on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Because they just put $1 billion into this diesel, and they got to get the return on that $1 billion. And that's going to take a decade.
That's what I mean, but with the 10 years out, they right. put that much money into it, and they've already planned it, and it's married up to transmissions, and you've got this whole long plan that's all seamlessly rolling out.
But I gotta
say, someone says, just throw this in there, and it's completely different. And it's got to be tougher.
Well, NIH is alive and well.
Alive and well. But I like this guy's attitude who just called in of saying, come on, let's get some good guys with wrenches and let's just put this thing in the car and go. I like that attitude.
Well, yeah.
That's what it takes to move things.
And if I was IndyCar, I'd say, come run your engine at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll make it legal.
Bradley Cross says, I'm a former Explorer owner. He says, won't the Explorer take sales from the Flex?
You know, we've done research on that because we were concerned as well. And what we found is Flex customers are very much Flex customers. A lot of them are coming from outside Ford. So over 50% of them are new to our brand. And when they turn their Flex in, 70% of them stay. So it's growing share for us. And the customers who have Flex absolutely love it. There are minivan customers. They are some SUV customers. the research that we did said Explorer customers like Explorer, Flex customers like Flex. Will there be some? Sure.
The Flex says,
but not much.
Strong word of mouth on Flex. People who have them are
love them.
Yeah,
right.
Huge.
But the sales are. Yeah. I mean, they're like, if I remember right, about $3,500 a month.
I don't really see a problem. I think exactly what Amy's saying. I think Explorer people are Explorer people. Flex people are Flex people.
We'll tell you something really interesting on Flex. We're about triple our share in California that we are in the rest of the nation. So it's doing really well in markets that we haven't always traditionally done really well in with cars and crossovers.
And, you know, in fact, the last I talked to Jim Farley about the Flex, which goes back at least a year ago, that's exactly what he was saying is it's bringing in customers, especially on the West Coast, who would never step foot in a Ford dealership.
I was just out in L.A. for the reveal, and there are Flexes everywhere. And so we're really happy with what Flex is doing for the brand. Customers love it. It continues to win awards. But Flex is not the center of the utility universe. Explorer is, and that is Explorer's purpose.
We got a couple of more calls here, too. Ben, let's bring them in.
John, this is Frank from Bridgeton, New Jersey. You've got to get off of this autonomous nonsense. Just imagine you're in your autonomous car going 150 miles an hour and there's somebody linked net behind you, 20 feet off your bumper. But they haven't properly inflated their tires. They haven't maintained their car. Now imagine that person's in front of you and a tire blows out. No, let me do the driving, please. Thanks, guys, and keep up the good work.
See, he forgot, though. You're not going to worry about this because you'll be drinking.
That's right. I won't care. And I'll have my big flat screen TV in the windshield, too.
There's something to be said for that. But you know what? We're not going to be drinking. We're not going to be reading something cool or watching TV. We're going to be on our BlackBerries doing more work. That's another reason why.
Yeah, don't remind me.
It's just more productivity gains. The man squeezing the worker, and the worker's going to be me. So, no, I'd rather drive. Thank you.
Okay. And let's bring in another call there.
Hi, this is Mike from Troy, Michigan. John, my question for your guest is, why did Ford go away from the truck platform more towards the car program, car platform with the new Explorer? Aren't they going to lose a lot of towing capacity with that vehicle? And I know people have been using the Explorer in the past to do towing, and it seems to be more rugged when it's on a truck platform. Thanks very much.
That's a great question, and that's one of probably the questions I get most. Why did you move to unibody? Most SUVs now are unibody. Range Rover is unibody. Grand Cherokee is unibody.
Jeep always has been.
Most are unibody. It's more efficient for us to do it that way. We get better fuel economy. We also deliver better ride and handling. We have not given up any capability. We have ground clearance that's actually a tenth of an inch more on the new one. When you think of a platform, think of a bill of process to send something through an assembly plant. What I can tell you is the Explorer meets our SUV durability. It is not car durability. It is very rigorous SUV durability. It is all truck. It is all SUV. But it is unibody to deliver ride and handling and fuel economy. We feel very good about the decision, and we haven't given up capability. Now, to address the question on towing, our towing is down from a little over 7,000 pounds to 5,000 pounds. We did that purposely. 5,000 pounds is really what most people tow. It covers between 80 to 90% of what people tow. If you want to tow more, we do have an expedition in our showroom. We wanted to make sure that we were giving you the most efficient vehicle, and that was 5,000 pounds with the enhanced towing trailer sway tow haul mode. But that was a conscious choice, not something that was driven by unibody.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the viewers got a good point. Body on frame is going to give you the ultimate in towing, but I think you make really good points. Everything is a compromise when you design a vehicle, and the compromises you guys went for was the ride and the fuel economy. Mm-hmm. And if you give up a few thousand pounds towing, so be it. Like you said, they'll have to get an expedition.
Do you guys have reliable market research on how many buyers in that segment actually tow?
Mm-hmm. Not many.
I didn't think it was. When the Japanese, really it was Honda and Toyota, first came out with the crossover, the unibody SUV, all the Detroit companies said, oh, nobody's going to buy them because all these people tow boats. And I said, wait a minute. I live in the Great Lakes. I never see anybody towing a boat. Like, you know, twice over the summer do I see somebody towing. I think it's a bunch of BS. I think you just don't want to engineer a new platform because you're making a lot of money on the old one. And that's basically what it was.
3% tow regularly.
3%?
15% tow occasionally. And that includes the 3%.
Actually, the 15 even surprises me that it's that much, but wow. Yeah, it is a small amount.
Okay, we'll take this as the last question. Andre Vieira wrote in. This is pretty good. He says, first, I'd like to just mention that Maury Chaykin died recently, and he was the guy I would have casted to play Peter DeLorenzo in Out of Line After Hours, the movie. For the record, John Hamm would play Bagger Welch, and William
John Hamm, that's awesome.
And William H. Macy would be John McElroy.
I can see it.
I've been stopped in the airport. People have said, aren't you? I'm not. That leaves either Philip Seymour Hoffman or Paul Giamatti to play Peter. My question to Amy is there going to be a Lincoln version of the Explorer?
How awful is it that the last question I can't answer? That's terrible.
Because you can't talk about future product?
Because I can't talk about future product.
There's your answer, Andre.
I'm sorry, Andre.
Well, real good.
Replace the MKT?
Don't you like the MKT?
No, I think it looks like a hearse.
Oh, I love it. I'm sorry, driving one.
But Peter loves your stuff, so and you're an engineer, so you know physics.
It's a great vehicle. I'm driving one this
week. It reminds me of the Nissan Quest minivan with that droopy back end.
David, it's a great driving vehicle.
Peter, it's uglier than...
But he likes a Synergy Green Camaro, so you got to give him some slack.
But I still haven't decided if I'm going to buy that.
Oh, okay.
I might just suggest a Mustang.
Yeah, I'd get a 5-liter Mustang.
I respect what Ford has done from a business standpoint with quality. And this is purely subjective, I don't like Ford design. The new Mustang looks all right, but I still think the Camaro and the Challenger look better. Mm-hmm. I just don't like Ford.
Challenger looks like a phone booth. Can't stand it.
Like a phone booth?
The phone booth on wheels.
No, now the Nissan Cube looks like a phone booth on wheels.
The best thing, the coolest thing about the Dream Cruise is when you see the original Challenger and the new Challenger within proximity, and you go, whoa, then you realize what I'm talking about. Hmm. The new Challenger is vertical.
Yes.
Tall. The old Challenger.
Much bigger car.
Yeah, the old Challenger was low. And
It's kind of grown on me. It's not in my consideration set because I'd get a Camaro before I got that. But
Challenger sounds cool.
I like it. I think it's a pretty cool car. But, Amy, thanks so much for coming on Auto Line After Hours. It's been great having you tonight.
Thanks. Yeah. It was fun.
And David, Peter, great having you guys back. I'm glad being back with you guys.
See, my wife's going to love that because she loves John Hamm.
Oh, cool. You let her know that.
Who's that caller?
He's not the first time.
Andre Vieira.
Not the first time someone's mentioned Giamatti and me.
Hey, everybody out there, remember, you can friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit. You can follow Peter at autoextremist.com and follow him on Twitter. He doesn't do it a lot, but sometimes he does get out there, and it's twitter.com/Autoextremist. You can see David Welch's work at Business Week, Bloomberg Business Week.
Businessweek.com and Bloomberg.com. We haven't.
Okay, haven't done it yet. Either way you want to type it in, folks, that's where you can go and get it. Remember, you can get our programs on your BlackBerry or smartphone via Stitcher. Just go to our website and look for the Stitcher icon, and you can follow everything there. Remember, August 18th, that's a Wednesday. We're going to move from Thursday to Wednesday just for that night because we're going to be on Woodward Avenue for the Woodward Avenue Dream Cruise. Should be an awesome show. We're going to go a full 2 hours there from 6 to 8 p.m., and thank you all for having tuned in tonight. Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.